Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. I apologize for our late start. I had to be on the House side with some testimony, and then we had a fire or two that needed had a little extinguishing. So that's now been done.
And only two?
Two since you and I last saw each other. So we're going to start with House Bill 2549. Let me open up a public hearing. And Chana, why don't you give us an overview, please?
Chair Przonski, members of committee, House Bill 2549 comes to you from Representative Greenlick. This deals with debts that are owed to state agencies. Currently, state agencies are required to assign debts owed on a liquidated or delinquent account to either a private collection agency or the Department of Revenue for collections within 90 days of the most recent payment or liquidation of the account. State agencies have some discretion not to assign the account in limited circumstances, such as when the debt is a judgment that includes restitution or payment to the Crime Victims Assistance Section, the account is in bankruptcy, the debt is less than $100, etc. House Bill 2549 creates an additional option for state agencies to decline to send a debt to collections when the debt is owed by an estate and the Department of Revenue has noticed that the estate has closed. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. This is ready to move today, should you wish to do that.
Thank you. We have three people that have signed up, Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Greenlick, and Nicole Gulish, I believe. Why don't you three come up? Thank you all for being here. I'm not sure who would like to start off.
I'll start briefly, Mr. Chair.
All right, Mitch. Go right ahead.
State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I'm really happy to be here today. I appreciate you hearing this modest bill that I introduced on behalf of Ms. Gulish. She'll also tell her story. It was one of those strange things where a constituent calls and says, something weird's happening in the state. I've closed my mother's estate several years ago, and I now have been informed by the state that she owes some money. And I called them and said, well, you can't collect it because she's dead and her estate has been closed. They said, well, we'll send it off to a collection agency, which they did. When I called and asked, why did you send this to the collection agency, DOR said, we don't have any choice. The statute tells us what we have to do. And even though we know we can't collect and the estate is closed, we're required by statute to send it off to a collection agency. This bill simply says it's okay not to send it off if you know you can't collect it because there's a closed estate. Senator, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from District 17, which includes House District 33. And frankly, I'm not sure I have a whole lot more to add to what Representative Greenlick has said and to what our mutual constituent will tell you, except to say that, you know, this strikes me as one of those situations that adds insult to injury. Somebody goes through the sadness and the loss of losing a loved one. They get through the hassle of being the executor of the estate and getting it all closed out, only to find out some years later that there's a debt they had no idea was owed, and there's absolutely no choice about how to handle it, and they've got collection agencies hounding them for something that they shouldn't be hounding them for. And we really need to just fix this very small issue. It's not, as Ms. Newell pointed out, there's no fiscal, there's no revenue. It's just giving DOR discretion in this case, these kinds of cases, as they already have in other similar cases. And it's a very simple technical fix bill, and we would very much appreciate your support. Thank you very much. And I would beg the committee's and my team's indulgence to let me go to my subcommittee, if that's okay, unless you have any questions.
Are there any burning questions for the senator before she flies out of here? You're clear.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank
keep
you.
Keep the money flowing.
Yeah.
Especially to my bills.
And Nicole?
Yes, just for the record, my last name is Gulish.
Gulish?
Gulish. Nicole Gulish.
I apologize.
No problem. I get that a lot.
I had that look when I said what I said, and I apologize.
No problem. So, yes, I was the executor of my mother's estate, and she died in December of 2006. And in April of 2013, I got a notice from PERS saying that she'd been overpaid in 1999. It wasn't a large amount, but, you know, it was an amount, and I immediately called them and said, you know, what do I need to do? She's deceased, and the estate has been closed for quite some time. And PERS said, well, just send us the case number, the judge, when it was closed, all that kind of thing, and we'll take care of it. I'm like, great, I can do all that. Sent off my email. And I thought that was the end of it. And then in August of 2013, I get a letter from the Department of Revenue from Oregon, state of Oregon, and it even says deceased on it. And I'm like, seriously? I thought I, you know, handled this with PERS. So I call them, and they said, oh, we'll let PERS know again. No one in this line tells me that these are the steps that have to be taken, whether the estate is closed or not. So each time I fulfill the obligation of what I need to do, I'm thinking it's the matter's closed. And then in April of 2014, I get this notice from a collection agency. So now I'm really kind of pissed. I'm like, seriously? I mean, I've told PERS, I've told the Oregon Department of Revenue. You know, I call the collection agency. They tell me that I have to go back to PERS. They're the agency that sent it. So now finally I get PERS to tell me this is the procedure. We have to go through all these steps. And so that's the point where I then write a letter or an email to my representative saying, seriously? I mean, I understand if the estate is open, which if anyone's had to go through that, you know, you send out a notice through the papers letting anyone know if there's anything out there, let's take care of it. We're talking years later. Obviously, I think it needs to be fixed. It's not a huge thing. It's just if the estate is closed, you've got paperwork showing that there's a case number, there's a judge that's signed off on it, there's no way to collect, why have the Oregon Department of Revenue step in for a step and then collections for another step? And it's, you know, it's hard to keep seeing someone's name that you've buried and they're long gone and saying, you know, I did my due diligence when I was the executor and everything got taken care of and this is just dragging on. So thank you. I'd like to see it changed.
Nicole, I think you can rest assured that it will get changed. Let me ask if there's any questions.
Just a comment. Actually, there is a fiscal impact on this because now these agencies won't have to be chasing down empty holes.
Well, this is true.
And it's going to save them some time and some money as well, as well as not irritating people that shouldn't be irritated. So yep. There's a real positive in this, I think, as well. So
there is.
One other comment that seems like there might be other situations similar to this, and maybe we should take a broader look at some of the debts owed to the state and see what's collectible, what really is realistic. I mean, this is not.
Yeah.
And see what really is owed to the state and go after it. So.
And thank you for the comment. I'm going to go ahead and make a comment. First of all, thank you very much, Nicole, for bringing this forward to your representative and your senator and for your willingness to come and testify. I'm assuming you probably testified on the House side. So now this is two trips, and so really thank you for doing that. The other thing is I'm not going to call up the representative that's here from Revenue, but I hope they're listening to me. I'm wondering why this has not been brought forward to us by the agency. This is clearly one of those scenarios that they know better, that they cannot be collecting this, and why we didn't get this from Revenue years ago, basically saying, hey, we've got this problem. We've got a obligation mandate that we have to do this and send this to collections. So I'm hoping that the representative that's here from Revenue, I will not out you by name because you're just going to be the messenger. Please make certain that if there are other situations that are similar to this, we'd like to know that. And in fact, what I would like to know, the relating clause on this one is regarding the state, so that's too narrow. But if there's other situations like this, we would like to know that so we can get on it. It may not be able to be addressed in this session, but we can clearly take care of these type of issues. These are what I call house cleaning type of measures that should have been brought to our attention, that, you know, the obvious that when you have had an estate that's been closed officially by law, there's no reason for it to go anywhere except into a we cannot go any further file and be done with it, instead of sending it to collections or anyone else to try to collect something that's unenforceable and that, as you said, the emotions that you have to continue to, let's say, resurface and live. So we apologize for that, and we'll make certain that this bill makes it across the floor.
Thank you.
You bet. Other questions or comments? With that, we're going to go ahead and close the public. Well, let me ask before I do that, after that little statement.
Senator
there.
Brzezinski, if the Department of Revenue had something to say.
I'm getting ready to ask right
now. Okay.
I said, is there anyone who would like to come testify on House Bill 2549? I'm not asking for the Department of Revenue to come up unless you want to come up and there's something that you'd like to say, Dina. Please come on up.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. For the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And while I am completely empathetic to the situation that happened to Ms. Golish and her estate, I wanted to let you know that there are currently protections. The account should have never been sent to a private collection firm or the Department of Revenue. And as soon as the Department of Revenue got the account in August of 2013, we sent it immediately back to PERS. So it's currently in the Oregon Accounting Manual, and it's already in the statute that you're amending, that if it's an open estate, it is deemed to be considered litigation. If it's a closed estate, it's to be considered for cancellation, and that's currently in the Oregon Accounting Manual that agencies are supposed to follow. So in this particular case, I believe PERS believed that they needed to send it over, and I don't know exactly why they needed to do that, but in the paragraph that you're trying to amend, it would be better for the agencies, if you want it to actually do what the representative and the senator would like it to do, I believe it needs to have an amendment, because the Department of Revenue, this only works as it's drafted if the account is actually sent to the Department of Revenue. In line 21 on page 2, we would recommend that the amendment say the state agency. So as soon as the agency that owns the debt realizes that the deceased is, that it's a closed estate, they don't even have to send it to us. The way it's drafted, they would have to reach out to us or contact us. We often know that a person has a closed estate, but we don't always. So I would recommend for the agencies to have the assurance that they really don't have to collect on a closed estate, that there's an amendment for line 21 that deletes the Department of Revenue and inserts the state agency. That would have allowed PERS to have the assurance that they, besides just relying on the DAS rules, but it would be in the statute that said that they don't have to send it to a private collection firm or the Department of Revenue. That's what this paragraph 9 in line 7 does. It says the state agency may, in its discretion, choose to not offer to assignment. And this is where the litigation exception is. Excuse me, and several others like small balances, that kind of thing. So they're adding a new exception that says if the agency knows that there is a closed estate. So as drafted, they would have to contact Department of Revenue to find out that the estate is closed if they don't already know. So in this situation with Ms. Golish and her family, as soon as PERS knew that she notified, then they would have the option to say they don't need to send it either to the Department of Revenue or our other agency account section or the private collection firm. Okay. For some reason, they believed they needed to, and they did, and we immediately sent it back to them.
All right, so that's what I'm going to, you know, since you've stepped up here and you want to, let's say, walk through this, I guess I'm going to have to ask a few questions, because based on the testimony I've heard, there was a letter that was sent to Ms. Golish that basically said, identified the person to be deceased. If that's the case, I'm trying to figure out what in the heck is Department of Revenue doing, sending something out that tells me that you are on notice that this was a closed account. And if, you know, if not, then we do need to have a little bit more investigation, because what I'm hearing is I understand that we want to make certain that the agencies on the front line understand that they don't need to send something to the Department of Revenue, mm-hmm. but don't pass, you know, I'm not ready to hear passing the buck, because to me there's also a duty and obligation on the part of the Department of Revenue to ensure that before they're trying to send something to collections, and you've had a a citizen that's basically come forward and said, my mom is dead, the estate has been closed, I mean, then you are on notice. And if y'all sent, and I'm assuming from what I'm hearing, that the debt was sent to a collection agency from the Department of Revenue versus PERS.
Mr. Chair, let me back up, and since Ms. Skolish is here, if you don't mind if I talk details about your mother's account. PERS assigned the account to Department of Revenue in August of 2013, I believe, like she said. And I think 4 days later, once we receive an account, we send an automatic letter out saying it's been assigned to us. You have the right to dispute it with the underlying agency. We looked, it got assigned to an agent. We looked, we saw immediately within, I think, 4 days that it had been, the estate was closed. And so we returned it to PERS. PERS is the agency that did send it to the private collection firm because they believed that they needed to do so under the current statutory structure. So in our case, yes, our system showed that the account was a deceased account. There are circumstances where we do actually collect on someone who's deceased until we find out that there is like a closed estate. In this case, we knew right away, and so we sent it back to PERS. In other cases, there might be assets or an open estate. There might be assets that we know about or we're waiting for someone to sell and the estate is still in probate. But the normal process is we consider, and this is DAS rules, that any account that we know has a closed estate is to be considered for cancellation. And so we did not send it to a private collection firm. Department of Revenue does not do that. We act in the role of a private collection firm for state agencies, and state agencies have a choice to send accounts from their agency collections to either a private collection firm or the Department of Revenue. And we have an obligation by statute to return it to the assigning agency as soon as it's determined to be uncollectible or we can collect on it if that's the case, if we believe it's collectible. In this case, we did not. And we sent it immediately back to the referring agency.
Okay. So then I guess the other perspective on this is that the testimony you've given today, it seems to be significant in the sense of the change that needs to be done. I'm going to ask if you or someone else from the Department of Revenue participated in the House hearings and brought this to their attention as to the change that you're recommending, which sounds like a good one.
Mr. Chair, I did not have the opportunity. I'm usually in the revenue committees, and so I usually have conflicts. In fact, I'm supposed to be there right now. But I did raise the concern with PERS. But in a practical sense, this is just kind of have a lot of an impact because we're already supposed to be doing this. So they would just be sending it to the Department of Revenue and maybe we thought an occasional ask if we knew that the account was closed or in a closed estate. And so we didn't see it as a particularly big burden. And so I didn't go to that hearing at that time, but I did share it with PERS. But as far as a practical sense to accomplish what they're trying to accomplish, I think that changing line, I believe it was line 21, and deleting Department of Revenue and inserting state agency instead would accomplish exactly what they're trying to do and allow the agencies to have the authority that they feel they do not have to not send an account to Department of Revenue or not send an account to a private collection firm. This would fall into one of the lists of liquidated the exemptions for referring.
All right. So we're going to take this definitely under consideration because I want to make sure we do it right and we're going to actually have that achieve the goals that we want. I also want to have DAS to have a representative here when we have our next meeting, since they're kind of like the superior of agencies, since they're the ones that should be coordinating. And I also like to have someone from PERS to come here as well. Other questions and comments?
Mr. Chair, if I may comment.
Yes, you may.
When I checked with the Department of Revenue, they said it was their obligation to do this. And if you Section J, line 21, modifies what's on line 7 in sub 9, which talks about the state agency. I mean, it references the state agency in the superior clause, and it seems to me if the Department of Revenue knows that under line 21 that the estate is closed. It really does obligate the agency, because this is referencing what an agency needs to do.
Yeah.
It may be an unnecessary step to get the Department of Revenue in, but that is the routine place that things come out of agencies to DOR for action. And it seems to me this is not an inappropriate way to do it. I do agree that if it said agency rather than DOR in that would probably solve the problem.
Yeah. Well, we're going to make sure we get the language correct. I do appreciate and understand that the Department of Revenue actually serves as a collection agency for all of our agencies. I just want to make certain there's more communication, and I also want to ensure that we make sure the buck stops somewhere, and we're not going to see this again.
Absolutely.
So, any other comments?
I just wanted to say that when I did talk to the collection agency, they did signify that it was PERS that wanted to collect, and I needed to contact PERS if I wanted the collection agency to back off.
Okay. So we're going to have a representative of them come in, and we're going to make certain, because this is a scenario from my perspective, PERS is one of those agencies that may see this on a more frequent basis than any other agency, and so we're going to make certain they understand the importance of them doing what they should have done based on what I'm hearing is in the manual for agencies.
You might ask them why it took them 15 years to figure out the amount was owed as well.
Yeah. We'll see how far we go on it. Mitch, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Again, thank you very much, Nicole.
Thanks.
Deanna, thank you.
All right, with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2549. We will get this scheduled for our work session, hopefully within the next 2 weeks. And then we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2331.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2331 is an interim committee measure that comes to you from the bar. This modifies the Oregon Uniform Trust Code. It codifies the early vesting rule. It aligns Oregon's code with federal tax code and guidance as it relates to separate shares and combination of separate trusts and separating one trust into multiple trusts. It also allows the trustee to include capital gains in the distributable net income when the gains meet federal regulation requirements. This had a unanimous vote on the House floor, has no amendments, no revenue, and no fiscal impact.
All right. I have two people that are currently signed up, Phil Jones and Eric Foster. The two of you would come forward. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2331? Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Whoever would like to lead off, if you'll give us your name first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Philip Jones, Chairman Senator Prozonsky and members of the committee. I'm Philip Jones. I'm an estate planning attorney in Portland with the firm of Duffy Keckel. I am joined here today by Eric Foster of Foster Denman. He is an estate planning attorney from Medford. We are both members of the executive committee of the estate planning and administration section of the Oregon State Bar. And that committee of the Oregon State Bar has written this legislation and has floated around among various constituencies in the estate planning community. And I am going to speak on two of the changes. One is in sections 1 and 2, and I'm also going to talk about a second change in section 4, and Eric Foster will talk about section 3. And of course, feel free to interrupt me with any questions. A first change is in sections 1 and 2, and it allows the person who creates a trust to decide whether the trust is going to operate as a single trust or whether it's going to operate as separate trusts. So, for example, if mom and dad were to put money in a trust for their three children, under this legislation, they would get to decide whether their trust is going to operate as a single trust for the benefit of the three children or whether it is going to operate as three separate trusts for the three children. And they, under this legislation, they would be able to make that decision in consultation with their estate planning attorney, who would be the person who would be drafting this trust and making that decision. This change brings Oregon in line with the Internal Revenue Code that has a provision known as the separate share rule that allows a trust set up in my example, for three people, three children, to operate as a single trust. It does not require it to divide itself into three trusts and file three separate tax returns, but it allows it to make some internal calculations. So the net effect is that it operates properly, but is still permitted to operate as a single trust. So again, this gives the people who are putting the money in the trust and are creating the trust, namely mom and dad, and their professional advisor, an attorney, and or an accountant, to make the decision as to how this trust will operate. The second change that I'm going to talk about is called the early vesting rule. And this is based on a series of opinions from the Oregon Supreme Court going back to 1911, in which the Supreme Court has consistently held, I think about a dozen times, that if you have a will or a trust that isn't particularly drafted very well and doesn't particularly state precisely when the interest of a particular beneficiary vests in that beneficiary, then it will vest at the earliest possible date. And so this deals with the situation of a beneficiary of a trust who dies perhaps a little bit out of order than people thought. Maybe someone died a little bit prematurely or a little bit later. A well-drafted will or trust will deal with that and will indicate where the money will go. But on a few occasions, a trust or a will is not drafted properly, and a decision needs to be made as to whether that person's interest vested in that person and then passes to his heirs or her heirs, or whether that person is basically erased from the trust and it passes to a different person who might be mentioned in that trust. And this is known as the early vesting rule. It's a very common judicial rule in Oregon and many other states. It's very helpful when a will or a trust has not been drafted properly. There are no court cases in Oregon that disagree with the early vesting rule, so it's not exactly a matter of controversy, but this will make it very clear under Oregon statutes that that is how Oregon wills and trusts are supposed to operate. So I will now either entertain questions, or I guess I'll let the chair decide whether to move on to my friend Mr. Foster. But thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer questions, and we do urge passage of this bill.
Now, what we'll do is we'll take the rest of the testimony and we'll put questions all out at the same time. So thank you.
Chairman Prozanski, members of the committee, my name is Eric Foster. As Phil said, I'm an estate planning lawyer in Medford. I'm here today to testify in favor of the proposed legislation that would allow a trustee of an irrevocable trust to include capital gains and distributable net income in three distinct situations that are authorized under the Internal Revenue Code and the Treasury regulations under Section 643 of the code. By way of background, trusts are generally taxed on their income at the highest marginal rate when trust income reaches $12,300. In stark contrast, individuals are taxed at the highest marginal rates when their income reaches $450,000. And so that distinction alone between trusts and individuals makes a huge difference in terms of the income taxation of trusts. In effective January 1st, 2013, Congress enacted a Medicare surtax, which adds an additional 3.8% tax on capital gains. That applies to individuals at a threshold of $250,000. For trusts, that applies at $12,300. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense for trusts to retain that income if they can manage to distribute it out to beneficiaries so that beneficiaries can be taxed at individual rates. In addition, individuals reach the 20% federal tax on capital gains at income levels of $450,000. Again, sounding like a broken record, trusts hit that at $12,300 of income. This legislation authorizes the inclusion of capital gains in distributable net income so that those capital gains can be taxed at individual levels. The three situations are the trustee makes an adjustment between principal and income, allowing capital gains to be treated as part of income, thereby passing the gain out to beneficiaries. trustees consistently treat capital gains as part of principal but as distributable net income on the books and tax returns of the trust, and trustees actually distribute capital gains to beneficiaries. This legislation would allow trustees to shift an undue tax burden from trusts to beneficiaries, which would ultimately allow the people who should be paying the tax, the beneficiaries, on at much higher income levels than trusts would otherwise. So I'd urge the committee to pass this legislation.
Great, thank you. So my colleagues here at the dais do not always get to have the opportunity to have a continuing legal education courses provided for them. So let's see if anyone has any questions on trust and estates. I'll have to out myself on this. This is the one class that I actually scored the best because I had a professor who wanted, I think, to update his forms. So we had an open book test type, and he basically wanted us to come in forms with the different types of trust and estate. I happened to work for a very large law firm at the time that I just went to the trust and estate department and took all of their forms, and I actually got a book at the end of the class. So with that, I guess I'm going to be the carrier of this bill.
Reasonable to me,
yeah. Mr. Chair. All right, so are there any questions? All right, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on our bill that's before us, which is House Bill 2331? All right. Gentlemen, I want to thank you all very much for coming to the Capitol today. And I know the travels sometimes are great, but I also know that from the State Bar's perspective, it's very important and very appreciative that we have individual members of the Bar willing to come before us to give us testimony, because it does, in fact, enlighten us. And as you can imagine, with the citizen legislature, there are many issues and that we tackle or try to tackle, and these are the ones that, without the certified smarts individuals coming forward and giving us this information, it's very hard to be able to understand what and why we need to do in making changes to our current system. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, so we'll go ahead and close the public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2331.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I need a discussion. None? Any objection?
I wouldn't even want to venture into this.
All right. And there are no objections. The motion carries, and we'll show Senator Verdick on the votes today. If she's not back with us, she's doing other legislative business, to being excused. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2331, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2362.
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2362 deals with protective proceedings, including guardianship and conservatorship. Under current Oregon law, parties in a protective proceeding may request attorney fees to be paid by another party, which includes the protected person. The court considers multiple factors when making this determination, including the benefit to the person subject to the proceeding by the action of the requesting party, the objective reasonableness of the position of the requesting party, the party's self-interest in the outcome, whether relief was sought, the relief sought was granted in whole or part, the conduct of the parties giving rise to the action. Among those, I believe there are 12 total factors that the court may consider. House Bill 2362 requires the court to give the greatest consideration, the most weight of consideration, to the benefit of the action to the protected person. This passed unanimously across the House floor. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Bob, it looks like you're on for giving us testimony. While Bob's coming up, anyone else interested today or wants to testify on House Bill 2362? Bob.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2362 today. The Disability Rights Oregon has for about 15 years now had a role in state law to review guardianship petitions and other associated pleadings that have to do with people who are subject to guardianship and may be placed in restrictive settings. So we see a lot of petitions. And as they come through, one of the factors that we inform people about who we contact to ask if they have any questions or concerns about their guardianship is about the fact that fees may be awarded in proceedings that come out of the protected person's estate. And so that in any proceeding, that's a possibility. Back in 2013, members of the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar came to you because they were concerned that there was not clear standards for how attorney's fees should be awarded in these proceedings. And they came up with a structure that has standards to be considered both for a court to consider whether to award attorney's fees and also the amount of attorney's fees that should be awarded. There are a total of 16 factors that a court might take into consideration, and in that statute, none of those factors is to be given precedence. One of the things that individuals that we've talked to about this have raised to us is, gee, isn't this protective proceeding about my interests? And shouldn't my particular situation be given the most consideration in a proceeding? And our response was, well, yeah, that makes sense to us. And so that's basically what this bill would do. It was just direct a court in considering all of the factors, to keep in mind that the entire proceeding exists in order to protect this individual who is incapacitated. And to make an evaluation with that in mind. It's important to remember that this bill does not direct a court how to rule. These situations are very much case-by-case types of situations in which a judge has to evaluate various factors. The bill merely reminds the court that this entire proceeding, the entire reason for being there, has to do with making sure that that person is protected.
Okay. Thank you for the testimony. Questions? All right. Is there anyone else, as I mentioned, want to testify on House Bill 2362? Not seeing anyone. Will close the public hearing. Open the work session on House Bill 2362.
Chair, I move House Bill 2362 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2362 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Gelser, you will be our carrier, please.
Thank you.
And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2362. And open up our last public hearing for the day, House Bill 2377. Shana?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2377 comes to you from the Attorney General. This deals with phishing. Phishing is a method of obtaining another person's personal information by posing as a legitimate company or business and somehow requesting or obtaining personal information. This can come in the form of a fraudulent website, emails claiming to be from a legitimate company, and by other means. House Bill 2377 makes phishing an unlawful trade practice actionable by the Attorney General, passed out unanimously. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. And Chair Przanski, we received a -1 amendment to this measure.
All right, thank you. All right, Cheryl, I know you're here, and then Tim Cowan, why don't you come forward? That's who I have listed now. And good morning.
We keep learning new words.
Yeah, fishing, yeah. Cheryl, are you going to start off?
Sure. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice, here today on House Bill 2377. Our anti-phishing bill, and no, it's not this phishing, it's email phishing. So as you probably know, the Attorney General enforces our main consumer protection law, which is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Occasionally we come to you for ideas for smarter enforcement. This is one of those ideas to combat phishing. So yes, phishing is when a fraudster sends an email trying to get your personal information or money or something like that. It is a very big problem. It's been around for a while, but it's still not going away. Verizon puts out a great cybersecurity report every year, and they still have it as the #3 concern that's out there. So it is, despite its name, a fairly serious problem out there. phishing is so successful because most consumers can't protect against what they don't understand. I have a friend who's a teller at a bank, and part of her training is to spend a whole day with cash, just so she gets the idea of what it looks like, what it feels like, what it smells like, so she has an idea of when a fraudulent bill comes through, something kind of rings in the back of her head to say, that doesn't look right. The problem with phishing is that, especially our consumers who aren't used to the internet, they don't have that alarm bell going off when they see an email coming through. For example, we had one come through our consumer protection hotline. This is just an example. This is something from somebody, jamie.ben.amazon@gmail.com. And this consumer had been selling some things online. He couldn't quite remember if it was eBay or maybe Amazon. But he gets this email, and it says, all you have to do is pay $3,000, and you've got $19,000 worth of income coming into you. Immediately when I saw this, I said, Amazon@gmail.com? Why would Amazon be using a Gmail account? They're kind of competitors. This doesn't make sense. But it, you know, it looks pretty convincing. It's got Amazon.com from Seattle, Washington on the bottom there. It's got the Amazon logo on the invoice. And so, even though this consumer was maybe a little more sophisticated than most, he ended up paying the $3,000 and he was out that money. But since some of us are a little bit maybe more in tune with email and the internet, we're able to know that this is the real Amazon services and can kind of just tell the difference by looking at it. So that's the problem. The fix here is just to add phishing to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to kind of give us a more precision tool to combat the problem. So that's the problem. That's the fix, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, let's go ahead and take the testimony from Tim.
Chair and committee members, my name is Tim Cowan, and I'm referencing Section 2.1. Okay. And I want to make sure, even though I believe it must be in statute now, making sure that it's protected. Just for the record, I am a petitioner against the city and the hospital, and I have one at the Oregon Court of Appeals. So with that said, in my written testimony, I'll just read the second paragraph. In an atmosphere already charged with mistrust, when Salem Health bought a home among them under assumed name, they paid $13,000 under the asking price. And I believe the last time I looked, Salem Health made $22 million, and they don't pay taxes. And the couple is an elderly couple, and they didn't understand because a realtor represented themselves as their client, being an attorney from Portland that wants to move down. And it wasn't until after they signed the papers they found out that the purchaser was hospital. And the reason why I bring that up is the neighborhood. I've already met with a couple groups. They're absolutely petrified that any time somebody buys a piece of property and now realtors are going after them, they don't know who is actually purchasing the property. So I just wanted to make sure that as you were going through your deliberations, you protected Section 2.1.
I just want to make sure we're on the same page, Tim, because you're talking about the main Section 2 and Sub 1. Or are you talking about under Section 1, 2? I just want to, because it looks like Section 2.1, there's no changes to be made in that section.
That is correct, sir.
All right. So
I just wanted to make sure that when changes were made, that was protected.
That doesn't get changed.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, clear. Thank you. All right, so the questions now, you said that there was a dash one, China?
Yes, Chair Przanski.
So the dash ones, are those from the Department of Justice?
Chair Przanski, I don't believe they are.
Could you give them a copy of that? Because that came in.
Thank you.
So are those from the Department of Justice?
Chair Brzezinski, I wish they were.
Maybe we should adopt those. So, Aaron, I didn't know if you had any comment on that, but since they had come in, we hadn't gotten quite on to OLS yet.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, the Department of Justice would object to any insinuation that Fish does not sound like the Grateful Dead. It is, in fact, the position of the Department of Justice that we at least cannot distinguish between those two bands. Usually by the 13th minute of a guitar solo, I can start to tease those things out, but for now I have to oppose.
I think we need to read this amendment for the record. This is hilarious.
I think we ought to do this.
We may not have to go into a work session right away. So, Ms. Cowan, every once in a while, there's sometimes we need to have a little levity in our committee, and this is what...
This is great.
Well, this is an opportunity for us, because we do have individuals that come before us on multiple times, and sometimes we just want to take a step back. We are very serious about moving 2377 forward. As much as the Dash ones are... would be probably voted out of committee. I'm not sure we'll be putting that in. We'll have to kind of think about that one. But I do assure you that on Section 2, Sub 1, there is no intention on the chair's part to see that change, and that will, in fact, stay in there.
Mr. Chair, I may need to look see if I have a priority bill left.
All right. Any other comments, questions on the bill itself or on the amendment? Now, we can't act on the amendment since it's not on OLS yet, so, okay. So I guess we're protected on that.
And it may be just as well as not there. So.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so with that, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2377. I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2377.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2377 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2377. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I see we have a culprit that's walked into the room. I don't know if we want to put him on the spot. We'll just say, is there any objection to the motion that's before us? Not seeing any. The bill does have the votes. It does pass, and we will have, I think on this one here, Senator Cruz, you outed yourself. And so I think Senator Cruz will be our carrier on House Bill 2377. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2377. And now we had, Senator Burdick, we had a couple of votes. I've shown on the record that you're excused, but if you want to vote on each of the bills, we can ask to suspend the rules to allow you to do that.
Oh, that's very kind, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
All right.
Which bills?
So, Chair moves for unanimous consent to allow Senator Burdick to vote on
2331.
On 2331 as well as 2362.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I vote yes on both of those.
Before we quite get there, is any objection to the motion?
Talk about this? Okay, never mind.
All right. And Senator Burdick, and how would you vote on 2331?
I would vote aye, Mr. Chair.
And on House Bill 2362?
I would vote aye.
All right. The record will reflect those votes, and thank you very much. With that, I think we're concluded for the day. I want to thank everyone for being here. Jeff, I want to thank you very much for your hard work on the Dash Ones. And with that said...
Mr. Chair, I'm very impressed. This is
well. Here's the thing. We're going to actually have Jeff play. He is actually a very talented musician.
Oh, really?
Multiple instruments. So we're working on a gig. So we're gonna get him into another performing state that... We're not sure which of the bands he's going to bring down,
yeah.
But we are going to have a little opportunity to have some music. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the committee for today. Tomorrow we are scheduled to be at 8:30, and with that, we're adjourned.
Pass marijuana.
Adjourned.
Pass marijuana.
And with that...